Welcome to Packet Pushers, a podcast on data networking, where real people discuss events, technology and work life in the networking industry. This week, we're talking with Scott Lowe and Ivan Pepinyak about Layer 2 Data Center Interconnects. But before we get going, we just wanted to let you know that we love to hear your feedback and also to get your input about the show. So feel free to get in contact and send us topics, send us questions, send us comments, because they frame the show for us and they help us decide where we want to go. You can get in contact with us by sending an email to packetpushers@gmail.com or check out the podcast website at packetpushers.net, or you can follow us on Twitter at @packetpushers, or we're even on Facebook. We have a webpage there. Just search for Packet Pushers and you'll find us. If you have time, could you hand on up to iTunes and leave some positive feedback and give us a good rating, because that's a great way for people to get in contact, to find out about the show and join in the community and grow the appeal of the show, which is important to the community and to everybody who's listening. But enough about that. Let's get into the meat of the show. Ethan, welcome back. What's been happening with you this week?
Not enough sleep. Something about holidays and days off means you end up exhausted at the end of that time. I don't know why that is, but in America, of course, it was the Thanksgiving holiday that we had over this past week, and I had that day and the day after off and just relaxed and enjoyed some time with family and friends, and I'm completely exhausted now. And so anything I say on this show is suspect, and I just want everyone to know that right off the bat.
So no different from any other week, really.
Hey.
Ivan Pepinyak joins us, returning after a bit of a hiatus. Welcome back, Ivan.
Thank you.
What's been happening with you lately?
Well, I'm snowed in.
But you live in the middle, on top of a hill somewhere, don't you?
I live at, what would be that in US, like 2,000 feet.
Okay.
So we are currently at 2 feet and growing.
2 feet. I'll bet your remote access strategy is highly developed.
Oh, yes. Two service providers, multi-home, dual net.
At your house? Oh, man.
Yes. One on copper, one on fiber.
That's awesome. I work in a data center backup. That's not that well connected.
Independent power generator.
I've got a 1 meg pipe to the internet.
my backup one is 4 meg.
Okay. And of course, Scott Lowe is with us this week. Scott, welcome aboard the show. We're so pleased you could get to join in. How you been?
I am Ben. Very well, thank you. And I appreciate the invitation. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Tell people a little bit about yourself and what you're up to.
Yeah, sure. So I come primarily out of the virtualization space. I've been working in the VMware and virtualization community, pretty popular and well-known over there. Published a couple books on vSphere last year. Spoke at VMworld a couple times and a few other virtualization conferences here and there over the past few years. And just recently pushing a lot more into the networking side of things. So it's a real pleasure to get to speak to three masters of the art, so to speak, with you guys.
Flattery will get you everywhere.
That's what I hear.
Oh, wow. That's funny.
That's funny. Yes. And the reason for today's show is that Scott Lowe and I were at VMworld in Copenhagen a couple of months ago, and we had planned to get together and have a discussion about, well, with a group of bloggers. There was a whole bunch of virtualization bloggers there in the bloggers lounge, and we missed each other for one reason or another. And so I thought we would get into this show to talk about that format. And the topic is fairly open. We're going to run this very fluid. So if today's show has a little bit less structure than you're normally used to, get over it, because we're just going to run it out loud. So, Scott, we wanted to talk about Layer 2 Data Center Interconnect, and you had a whole bunch of questions that you wanted to throw us. Why don't you kick off with a starting point for us?
Well, so I'll give some background. You and I traded emails and DMs on Twitter and all that kind of jazz before the conference and during the conference. But the thing was, there's ever since Cisco introduced OTV and then EMC came out with their VPlex product, which is a storage federation product intended to make storage active in multiple locations at the same time, two locations at the same time. There's been a lot of discussion and much greater focus on this idea of data center interconnects and how do we take our two data centers and put them together, and should we and shouldn't we, and if we do, then what's involved, and the whole idea of long distance vMotion and all that. It's an area that a lot of people are intensely interested in, but most everyone has questions about how it can be done, whether or not it should be done, what's the best way to do it, Then we get into discussions, you know, that are very germane in the virtualization space, like, you know, should I stretch my VMware clusters across sites? And if so, what are the considerations for doing that? Those kinds of things. And what I was really excited about getting on the call with you guys today was to say, okay, here are three guys who are, you know, very, very skilled and talented in the networking space, you know, recognized as knowing what they're talking about here. I'd love to be able to just pick their brains about what it looks like, you know, what are the methods that a virtualization-centric guy or gal, whatever the case may be, should look at? What are the things they need to worry about? You know, how can we foster some sort of better communication between networking and virtualization around this particular topic? You know, what are some things that you guys, being in this, you know, on a day-to-day basis, what are some things that you guys see that you'd love to say to us, you know, quote unquote, us, the virtualization guys, you know, hey, you really need to be aware of this and you really need to watch out for this. And what are some things that we would like to say to you, quote unquote, the networking guys, you know, well, this is what would be helpful for us. Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. All right. I tell you what we'll do. We'll kick off the first one. Let's talk about long distance vMotion and the challenge of around doing long distance vMotion. So to summarize that, And correct me when I'm wrong here because my VMware skills aren't awesome. VMware needs to be able to vMotion a machine between vMotion a guest between two machines. There has to be two interfaces in the mix that have to be extended between the two servers. One is the vKernel interface, and the other one is the actual interface that the data to and from the guest is going. Is that correct, Scott?
Yeah, well, it is essentially correct. The VM kernel interface is the one that handles the actual pushing of the VM guest state, you know, memory pages and all that wonderful jazz. And then there's an interface that the guest is using that is its front end traffic. You know, it's how it's communicating with the outside network. Now, right. There's some question as to whether the VM kernel interface actually needs to be layer two.
It doesn't have to.
Yeah, and that was something that came up in a discussion on my own site some time ago, is that VMware has now removed that layer two requirement for the VM kernel interface, meaning I can route that vMotion traffic, but it's still the front end that we have to have the same VLAN present on both sides because the IP address doesn't change when you do the vMotion.
So that, exactly. Is that right, Ivan? I wasn't aware that had changed. That can be layer three between sites.
vMotion was always layer three. It's running over IP. The problem was that if you don't have VLAN for the VM interface, then obviously the virtual machine, as you move it, will lose the TCP sessions. And so to make sure that things really work the way they should work, VMware just required vKernel interface to be bridged.
Because that was just easier.
Yeah, that was easier to explain to people. You have to have everything bridged. There never was a reason, at least as far as I was involved with vMotion, to have a bridged interface on the vKernel interface.
Okay.
Yeah, and I would second that comment from Ivan. You know, the requirement for that VM kernel interface to be bridged, you know, layer two only, was in my mind always only a support thing, meaning this is what we're willing to support, not necessarily this is what works. And now it's evolved.
Let's just understand the requirements of what we're trying to achieve here. I've got two VMware servers running. The vKernel interfaces are connected between. They've got a shared VLAN at the front that a guest, an operating system guest, is connected to. So when a vMotion happens, what actually happens between over the vKernel interface then? Does it actually start to synchronize the memory pages and the CPU state? Is that what happens over the vKernel interface?
Yeah, that's exactly what happens, Greg. You're right on target. What happens is the VM kernel interface, they set up a TCP session between the two hosts. I think it's on TCP port 8000, if I recall correctly, but don't quote me on that. But they'll set up a TCP session between the two hosts, and they'll start shooting memory pages across. And so it will shoot all the memory and state of the machine across in a series of successive transfers until it gets down to the point where the difference between the source and the destination is so small that you can stun or basically pause that VM for a brief, just very, very brief moment, move it over, and then resume it. And in that very, very brief moment where that VM is stunned, that's where you have the possibility of dropping, you know, a ping or maybe, you know, a couple of packets here and there or something, but not enough to reset a TCP session or anything significant.
Oh, an application normally doesn't notice the outage is what you're...
Yes, that's correct. That's
so
correct.
The higher layers, you know, even though the system might go out for, say, 50 milliseconds or 250 milliseconds, the application won't notice.
That's correct.
Right. Yeah. So, and all that sync occurs over the vkernel interfaces.
That's correct. All that happens over the VM kernel interface, you know, and it's typically very, very quick. I mean, you can watch it happen if you're geeky enough and you want to run ESX top on your system. You can watch all the data get transferred and see the whole process occur.
Yeah. So now, of course, once the control is transferred from the machine on the left to the machine on the right, then the ARP cache something has to change here. And there's two things that need to change then to allow that guest to be addressable the MAC address will be transferred over because the guest OS will have its MAC address and it will suddenly...
It is transferred over.
Yeah. So the MAC address doesn't change. It has to stay the same because the router that's onto the VLAN has no way of updating the MAC address. And the switch will learn its bridging table will update because it'll start seeing the MAC address coming in, packets for that MAC address being received on that port. Because the transfer of control has gone from left to right, that server will start transmitting Ethernet packets. The source MAC address will be loaded into the bridging table, and that will be flooded throughout the switching network saying that MAC address is over there.
Right.
Okay. So...
Well, Greg, yep. There's a minor detail. Unless the moved VM sends a broadcast, the source MAC address will not be flooded. So some hosts or some switches might notice the change and some might not.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, I believe the VM issues a gratuitous ARP broadcast when it lands at the other end.
Perfect. That's what I wanted to hear. Thank you.
I was getting there. I think I was winding up for that. We have these two things that are going on. Now, my understanding of the challenge then that we have to do, so let's say we're now going to extend the left side and the right side, and we're going to extend those over some extended geographical distance, say, you know, however long it is. What are the challenges we're going to face at the networking layer? One challenge you're going to have is that the vkernel interfaces where the data has to communicate, they have to approach a coherent state. That is, the data transfer between the two machines has to happen at a fast enough rate so that as the memory changes, the memory pages and the memory data changes on the left side, it's propagated to the right side so that when they eventually hit sync, control can actually transfer from one side to the other. Now, the latency of the distance between those two is going to be one factor which can prevent that from happening. And I believe that is the factor that drives... I believe the current recommendation is that you can't have VMware servers more than 50 or 70 kilometers apart.
I think the maximum is 100 kilometers, or they define it as a maximum round trip time of 5 milliseconds.
Yeah, but I suspect this has more to do yet again with the support side and the fiber channel that has to run in the background to synchronize the storage.
Yeah, well, we haven't even brought storage into the mix yet because that's a whole other discussion entirely.
Yeah, I know, but you know, we've been testing vMotion over like 100 meg links, so over some really slower speed links compared to what you have in the data center, and it always synchronized.
Is that with servers that are under heavy load? I can imagine that a VMware server which has got a lot going on. Let's imagine it's a SQL server, and there's a lot of data.
A different story.
Yeah. And so the memory pages would be changing, and so the traffic that would be ejected out of the vkernel interface that it would have to synchronize with the machine on the other side could be very heavy, and the systems may never actually be able to exchange enough data to achieve a synchronous state.
Yeah, absolutely agree. If you're running a SQL server that caches a lot of things in memory...
And they're changing all the time.
Of course, you have a serious problem.
But on 10 gig or 1 gig, and in a local LAN where the propagation delays are like milliseconds, you're always going to achieve a synchronization because, you know, provided the machine can eject packets fast enough, the VMware server can actually get packets out of over the NIC fast enough, it'll achieve synchronization.
Right.
Yeah, and now they made it even more aggressive. So, Scott, what's the current bandwidth it can actually use?
So on a 10 gig connection, it can actually swamp a 10 gig connection or come pretty close to saturating a 10 gig connection with a maximum of up to 8 simultaneous vMotions between two hosts at the same time.
Excellent. Okay, so now we have two machines, a vkernel interface. So what we're saying is a 5 millisecond propagation delay is the current best effort guideline that comes from VMware. So really, in terms of synchronizing two VMware machines between sites, the 5 millisecond is sort of a rough rule of thumb. And if you transpose 5 milliseconds, it sort of adds up to about 100 kilometers. Is that about right? But you could really get it quite a bit further if the actual state of the machines wasn't all that complicated. That would be one. If they were simple web servers with largely static memory paging, you could probably synchronize them much further because you could achieve synchronization over the latency would be less of a problem. You wouldn't need so much propagation.
Yeah, conceivably that's true. If it were a very idle system, then potentially you could achieve synchronization of the VM state over a longer distance. Exactly what that limit is hard to say. But again, we bump back into that supportability argument.
Okay. So now let's talk about the front side. So we've got the guest. It transits from the left data center to the right data center. There's a few challenges that then occur at layer 3. So one of the problems that you have is what I call the traffic trombone, and which Ivan's blogged about rather extensively, is where the IP address of that server is tagged to the left data center, and it's routed in through the left data center. And when the machine moves over to the right data center, traffic comes in through to the left, across the layer 2 interconnect to the right data center, back to the left data center, and then back out to the client. And so you have this, the traffic to the server actually crosses the interconnect.
Twice,
out and back. Yeah.
Oh, right. And don't forget the database traffic, because the server might query the database that's still sitting in the old data center.
Well, that's when we start getting into the storage discussion, and I think for the sake of this particular discussion, we should just, to make things easy, we should assume that we have a solution like vPlex on the back end that keeps the data synchronized behind it. Because otherwise, then you're absolutely right, Ivan. Then you run into the discussion of, hey, you've got a VM in the right data center, and it's running queries against storage, which reside in the left data center. So both the request to that storage and the response from that storage both incur latency, which then drives performance, down through the floor.
Yeah, but I didn't have that in mind. Unless you have a very simple application where everything is running on a single host, you have TCP sessions going to, if you want, back office hosts. So your web server might talk to a SQL server, which then talks to the storage.
That's very true.
And if you move the web server, the SQL traffic is still going over that link.
Yes, yes. And so the idea of then doing vMotion for multi-tier applications becomes very complicated. Do we move just one tier of the application, or do we move all the tiers?
Exactly. Which brings me to the fundamental question. Why would you ever want to move a VM between data centers?
So, and that's a perfectly valid question, I think. There's two arguments. One is a little better and the other is not so good. First, the argument is something we've started referring to as disaster avoidance. Okay. You know something's coming that's going to affect your data center, and you want to vacate your data center in advance of that event occurring. Common here in the States, in certain areas of the States anyway, are hurricanes. So you might have a company who has headquarters in Florida or on the Gulf Coast or even here in North Carolina where I am, and there's a hurricane coming, a Cat 4 or a Cat 5 hurricane on the way. And you've got your data center sitting in an area where it could be affected. You want to vacate your data center out of the way. That's one example.
Okay, Scott, sorry. So you're having mission-critical applications that you can't stop and move. You want to keep them running while you move them. Is that the idea?
Yes.
Okay, so if you have mission-critical application, why don't you put a load balancer in front of it?
I was just thinking that. Why wouldn't you use DNS or something to just basically swing that traffic to another data center?
You put a load balancer in front of it. Then you start the second VM in the second data center. When they're both running, you take the first one out of operation.
Okay, but then that's fine. You can do that for certain applications. Then no big deal there. You could do that for the front end tier of a multi-tier app. But what about the database application?
Okay, so if you have the database that's running on a single host, don't you have a redundancy problem?
Mm. You could potentially be running a virtualized cluster.
Yeah, but still, you have...
You could be running an Oracle rack cluster, for example, where the data is coherent.
That's a different story.
Yeah. One of the things that I can think of, for example, is SharePoint. You can't have SharePoint existing in two different sites at the same time.
Oh, I love Microsoft.
I don't.
Oh, do I have to put explicit sarcasm tags around my...
I'll make sure I put a sarcasm tag on when I send it to iTunes. I mean, SharePoint is a classic case. Let's pretend that we're not at some... We're in a typical corporate environment where you're stuck with whatever you get stuck with. You know, the guy who sits over in the corner over there has spent 6 months negotiating with a vendor, and he turns up with a product and says, this is the product I have to deploy. And you take one look at it and you realize it's handwritten in Access. And that's what SharePoint is. It's you know, handcrafted ActiveX controls done by a bunch of engineers because it seemed like a good idea for something that they wanted to do. It was never built as an enterprise product, as far as I can see. Any product that has a whole aftermarket to make it go fast enough and make it secure, it's a sure sign it was badly designed to start with.
But, so you're talking about SAP?
So with those things in mind, let's just pretend it's something like that, where the application is monolithic and can't be moved, and your enterprise has it, and you can't have it existing in two data centers. I mean, I've worked in web companies where we had fully coherent data centers, and you know, web servers in both data centers are lit active, and it goes all the way back to a coherent data store in the back. You can have applications like that, but in an enterprise, it's very rare to get that, I think.
I don't know that I would say it's very rare, but it's certainly less common.
Well, it might be something that happens for certain key applications that were done properly, but you know, there's vast numbers of mid-tier applications in terms of functionality and criticality that don't have that. And so,
agreed.
Yeah, and that's the reality. That's the real world, isn't it?
Okay, so we have an application that can only run on a single VM. And people still pretend it's mission critical, so we want to move it over to the other data center, right?
Right.
Okay. So what's the second argument?
So the second argument, the first argument was disaster avoidance, okay? And yes, there's a list of caveats around that. But the second argument is disaster recovery. But that argument is very, very weak for a number of reasons. One, a lot of people don't understand vMotion is for planned outages, not for unplanned outages. I can't vMotion a VM from one host to another if the first host has gone down.
Oh, you can with fault tolerance.
Well, but that's a different story, and that's not really vMotion.
I know.
you're muddying the waters here, Ivan. But a lot of people think that, you know, using this sort of long distance vMotion data center interconnect kind of technology will help them with DR, when it's really not a DR solution. You can consider it a business continuity solution under certain circumstances, but aside from that, the other potential reason, I know that I said there were only two, maybe there's three, would be even weaker, because there are other ways of doing this, and this would be some sort of workload balancing. But as you pointed out, there are lots of network-based ways to address that as well, if the application supports it.
Yeah.
Okay. So I guess if I look back over the discussion we've had for the last few minutes, the whole discussion rotates around what the application needs and what the application wants. And so, at a networking sense, we would even have to have a view of how that application looks and how it performs to be able to make some conclusions about what the network needs to do with it. Is that if you've got a layer 2 synchronization, a vkernel synchronization happening between two data centers, okay, the first primary challenge that you have to solve, from my view, is that traffic trombone. So if you've got a server that suddenly flips from, you know, London to New York, and now all of a sudden you've got customer traffic coming into London and then being handled by a server in New York, so it crosses the transnational interconnect, hits New York, gets processed, and then the response back to the customer comes all the way back to London and then out to their client. Now, that's one problem that you've got to solve. So that, and I call that the traffic trombone. The second problem that you've got is, let's say that at any given point in time there's four vMotions going on at a single point in time. And you can then have a situation where there's four traffic trombones happening between point A and point B. And let's assume that those four guest OSs that have suddenly flipped to New York are all on the same VLAN. Because of the way Ethernet quality of service works, there's no way to pick out which of those four servers is more important to each other, or to guarantee service for any one of those servers, because there's no quality of service tagging for an Ethernet frame.
Oh, there is.
Well, there is in VLAN trunks, but these four guests are all in the same VLAN.
No, every single packet has the VLAN tag, and within there you have the three bits. It's not per VLAN, it's per packet.
So I guess the question Greg has is, how do you distinguish if within a given packet you've got four VMs and they're all in the same VLAN, how do we distinguish VM A, VM B, VM C, and VM D from each other so that we can apply quality of service to one of those four specifically, not the whole VLAN as a unit?
Yeah. For example, this is the big problem with Ethernet, is to my mind, is one, in VLAN, so in a given layer 2 domain, there is no QoS or no effective QoS tools with the technology that we have today.
Okay, not completely agree, but let's not go there. You're pretty close.
Yeah, I mean, sure, we could dream something up, right? We can actually apply rate shaping using MAC address filters and things like that. But effectively, in terms of real-life deployment, you can't use those tools.
Okay, now the only thing you could do is somewhere on an access switch, you could go and look into the actual IP headers, because you can still see them, and then relabel the QoS field in those packets, and then you queue them through a core.
But where would the QoS be applied? Doesn't it have to be applied on a layer 3 interface?
Not necessarily.
It could be done on an Ethernet.
It depends on the platform, yeah.
It depends on the platform.
Okay, so we're in a data center. Got a Nexus 7000.
Oh, Steve Rosen had something to say about this feature not working on the Nexus, I think.
Yeah, the cost on the Nexus, from what my research shows, isn't brilliant yet. They haven't solved some of these layer 2 QoS challenges yet. Perhaps it's coming in the future. There's no MPLS on the Nexus 7000, so you can't...
Oh, you won't see that for a long time. Hmm. No, I'm just guessing, because obviously they have a chipset problem on the older blades.
Yeah, everything's hardware, so it'll be new blades. You'd be forklifting out your blades in the future. So you'd have, let's assume that you've got a 6500 on the edge, and your layer 2 packets are coming up into a 6500. Crossing a Nexus 7000, VMware servers, I'm waving my hands around on the virtual whiteboard. I hope you're watching.
No. We got it.
Yeah. You're good. Keep going.
So we've got a VMware server, 10 gig down to a Nexus 7000. Nexus 7000 is connected to a 6500, which is your network edge, which is your layer 2 data center interconnect to a second data center. What would you do for the layer 2 on the 6500 to be able to granularly detect traffic for a given server?
No problem. I think the 6500 is way too late. I mean, if you would have the priority bits set in the VLAN tags, then yes, you can queue on that, theoretically. But it depends on what...
But there's no tag. The packets that come out of the VM are untagged Ethernet frames.
They have to be tagged. Out of ESX server, they have to be tagged.
Right, but that tags for the entire VLAN. Let's say all four VMs are in the same VLAN.
Yeah, but you have three bits in the VLAN tag where someone can indicate the QoS.
Oh, you're saying QoS classify on the source IP address and mark the VLAN tag appropriately?
Yeah.
Okay. So where you'd do that on the Nexus 7000, you're saying?
Oh, you can't do that on the Nexus 7000. That's what I said before.
So then you'd have to do it on the 6500, but by then it's almost too late.
It is too late. By the way, Greg, depending on the DCI method you use, and now we're getting deep into where we didn't want to go. If you use something like PseudoWire over MPLS over GRE over IP.
Yeah.
Then the only packet that sees the actual congestion is the IP packet. And the congestion doesn't propagate back. There's no back pressure going back to the pseudo-wire. So you can't queue on the pseudo-wire because there's no back pressure.
That was the problem I had, because I was also looking at an ME3400, which has some quite fancy hierarchical QoS capabilities, which allowed you to has some very nice features in terms of being able to do lots of layer 2 QoS and all sorts of fun things. But I still couldn't work out how to provide back pressure and signal back into the guest VM to slow down, or to, you know, how do I shape according to a given, yeah, I couldn't make it all line up.
No, the problem you encounter is inside a 6500.
Yep.
You can't even get back to the VM. Even within the 6500,
yes,
you get an output queue of IP packets.
Okay, so the current answer then, let's probably best to keep moving on, but the current answer is the only way to solve that problem is to have enough bandwidth for all four machines to work at line rate.
Well, actually, as they will start sending the traffic across, they will experience delays due to queuing. So TCP sessions should slow down.
They should. What about if you put a WAN accelerator in between those two data centers? What's that going to do to that traffic?
It depends on your traffic.
Hmm. Does a WAN accelerator do anything for vkernel traffic, for VM?
Do you have a WAN accelerator that works at 10 gig?
They want to. They think they do.
No, I haven't seen anything that big. Nothing I've seen pushes more than a gig that I've worked with. It's just a lot of CPU to get that done. And then depending on what's inside that TCP conversation, there's limited amount of benefit that we're going to see anyway.
You can probably get some protocol optimizations, you know, do some header.
Yeah, get a 2x at least out of it. But can you get big compression and that kind of thing, which has a whole lot to do with what kind of data is inside those packets flowing between the two data centers?
Well, it's very popular to use a WAN accelerator for storage replication because that is often highly compressible.
Exactly.
Now, I know that F5 has been pitching their stuff to help in this whole argument, but I don't know the details on exactly how that would work. So maybe there's a potential future Packet Pushers podcast subject for you.
Well, we actually talked about that several months ago when they first released that in the 10.2 code. And part of what they are doing is their own flavor of WAN optimization to make that go. But I don't remember the ratios of how much compression that they were seeing. But what F5 wants you to do is license their WOM, the WAN optimization module, and build a tunnel between the two F5 boxes so you can effectively do, I don't remember if they're actually doing a vMotion or not, but effectively you're taking a pool member that lives in one data center, pumping it across a tunnel into the F5 that's in your other data center and bringing that pool member and spinning him back up when you've kept the same IP address. You still got the traffic trombone problem. You still got clients that are stuck to the original F5. It's not a solution that's going to help you for the whole, if the whole data center is going away. But it's an interesting back and failover scenario.
What you do, Ethan, they do more than that.
Mm-hmm.
So what they actually do is they build bridging over IP.
Ether IP tunnel, yeah.
Yeah, so they're extending a VLAN.
Right, yes.
VMware does the vMotion, so they don't care how vMotion happens. VMware moves the machine.
But don't they attach some intelligence to that? And then actually will move the front-end VIP from side to side as well. So their value isn't the Ether over IP or their Ether, their so-called Ether IP. It's the fact that they're content-aware.
Yeah, what they do is they connect to the vCenter. Mm-hmm. So they know which virtual machines are local and which are remote. And they give higher weight to the local machines. So they're trying to keep the remote machines not used, if at all possible.
So they're just essentially, they're making their product VMware aware,
yes,
so that it can apply its load balancing algorithms to route traffic to a closer VM, so to speak.
Exactly.
Well, and it's integrated into vCenter so that the VMware administrator can make this happen through vCenter without having to actually touch the F5 box.
Exactly.
Well, that's kind of handy.
And what you can do is you can announce the same IP address through both pairs of load balancers.
Any cost?
I don't think...
Well, wait a minute. On the front end, you're saying, Ivan, the same virtual IP out the front side?
Yeah,
or?
That's what I understood.
Yeah, maybe that's different, but I understood not, because we talked to F5 at some detail about that, and that was one of the shortcomings of the design, was your client coming inbound was still going to be stuck to the opposite data center, even if the pool member, say it was a persistent connection, and that pool member had just gotten moved. Well, now they're still coming into the one data center, getting shot through the Ether IP tunnel to the F5 at the other data center to hit their pool member if it's that sort of a connection. There wasn't any way to move the VIP over, last I knew, unless that's changed and they've gone down the road with that.
Oh, I just answered one of my questions. Thank you.
Well, we're here to help, Ivan. Some of the challenges are QoS. How do we discriminate between the different machines if they're all in the same VLAN? So this is one of the problems. This is part of the problem with the flat Earth network that I call it. You know, people sit around and say, but the Earth should be flat because that makes it easier. And so having a single layer 2 domain for all of the guest machines so that they can vMotion around has got quality of service issues in terms of making sure that critical machines can get bandwidth inside a VLAN. Once they get outside the VLAN and start moving around the data center, we can actually start to QoS them, but that's one issue. The second problem I have with single layer 2 domains, which is much propagated by VMware. Let me tell you a story. When I was at VMworld, Scott, do you remember they had that event where we met up with all the execs from VMware? And a guy called Alwin Sequeira was trying to convince me that you can put 30,000 VMs in a single VLAN, no problems, guaranteed to work, he said.
Oh, yeah. Was that event over at the CTO office event or something like that?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, I've been trying to get Alwin to come on the show, but he's been a bit hard to get a hold of and to talk about that and how and to explain the testing and the logic behind that. But here's my experience of having very large VLANs. To some extent, it's historical. And in the past, over the past 20 years, we've had simple problems where networking protocols of the day were very broadcast intensive, and that would cause a problem. Every broadcast packet, every machine has to process that. That remains a problem. When you've got 1,000 servers, there's still broadcast traffic happening, although at a much lower rate today. But by far the biggest thing is that it's a single fault domain. So with one big VLAN with large numbers of machines in it is a single fault domain. And there's two things that can affect a fault domain, and that is a bridging loop, because Ethernet has an Ethernet frame has no TTL loop. So if a packet goes into a loop, it will loop indefinitely, and it will never be pulled out of a loop, which is different from IP, because IP has a TTL field in it, and it will only propagate so many hops before it'll be pulled out and taken out of the flow. And so a loop is never infinite. It only happens for a short period of time. The second thing that's happened happens so irregularly now, but used to be very common, is that Ethernet adapters fail. And they quite often fail by generating Ethernet packets or a signal on the Ethernet wire, which is all ones or high voltage. And that's effectively a broadcast to every other device on the network. And that takes out an entire VLAN in one hit. That used to happen a lot. And I've still seen it happen. I saw someone the other day was saying they had a faulty, on Twitter was saying they had a faulty NIC, and it took an entire whole switch down until they worked out which machine it was. So there are two issues with big flat VLANs that I have a problem with, which I don't think have been addressed today. Ivan, is that still true? Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I'll just add one other scenario. Just imagine that for whatever reason you set up a huge UDP flow between two machines, and the second machine goes down and the UDP flow is still flowing. Imagine what will happen when the MAC address ages out. The same UDP flow will go to every
unicast flood. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Unicast flooding will kill you.
Yeah, that sounds pretty bad.
Mm. And this is what I talk about with a fault domain. So even if you don't understand all of the issues that we've just talked about, one fault in that layer 2 domain from an Ethernet packet will take out every host in that layer 2 space.
So here's a question I have, because I get what you're saying, at least at the high level, but one of the things that keeps coming up is that we are pushing larger layer 2 domains because of this need for layer 2 adjacency between the interfaces that are handling VM traffic. So, you know, whether it be two VMware ESX or ESXi hosts sitting in the same data center or in two different buildings, or, you know, as we're talking about, two different data centers that are some distance apart. But are we really talking about enlarging the L2 domains, or are we just talking about stretching the L2 domains? See, from my perspective, I don't advocate that people put more and more hosts on a single L2. I just say that L2 or collection of L2s has to be present in more places. In other words, if I say that I've got a VLAN and we define a VLAN as being a layer 2 domain, I think that's accurate, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so we say I've got a VLAN. I'm not going to tell somebody to put 1,000 hosts in that VLAN, whether they're virtualized or not virtualized, because to me that just is silly. What I'm going to say is now I want the same, you know, let's say I use a /23 and I'm going to put 500 hosts. You know, I feel like I've That's a reasonable piece. Okay, I'm going to put 500 dose. Maybe I'm going to stick 250, you know, standard, you know, slash 24, whatever.
Yep.
But I'm just talking about having more layer two domains that are visible in multiple places rather than one big one. I mean, is there a distinction here? I mean,
yes, you're going in the right direction.
Okay. I mean, so I guess from that perspective, how much of that stuff that you just mentioned, Greg, is still applicable? I mean, if we're still telling customers, and it sounds like we should be telling customers, you don't want bigger L2 domains. You just want your L2 domains available in more places.
Yep.
Does that address some of the concerns that you brought up?
Scott, the problem is that if you want to move your virtual machines between ESX servers, you have to have all the potential VLANs enabled on the access ports on the switch, which means that you've effectively killed all the isolation you had before. Because if one VLAN goes crazy with broadcasts, then everyone that's listening to that VLAN will be impacted.
So the very fact that we are making these interfaces, trunk interfaces, you know, because we plug into an ESX or ESXi host and we say, hey, just give me a .1Q trunk and allow this number of VLANs across it. But what I'm saying is the fact that we're allowing these VLANs across it, is that what is making, therefore, the broadcast domain larger and potentially exposing?
Yes.
Okay. So would a VLAN pruning type solution where the host was aware of whether or not it needed a VLAN, would that solve the problem?
That would make it way better, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, up to a point. That's a best practice, and that's what most vendors do, but it only prunes VLANs that are unused.
Yeah, the big problem that I still see with that is you've got a problem that would have been isolated to one data center, a broadcast storm, whatever the problem is. Now you just shove that problem into your other data center now because you're bridging that layer two VLAN across what used to be a hard boundary.
There's a couple of things. One is layer two issues are extremely difficult to resolve because you can't see them and you can't trace them very readily. They tend to take the device out. The switches go out with them. The second thing is that once your weakness in this is the layer two data center interconnect. It's normally the least amount of bandwidth because buying a 1 gig layer two pipe from one side of the country to another is not a cheap event. It's 1 gig, or maybe you have 2 1 gig pipes, say, right? That's still not a 10 gig pipe. That's your weak point. And so if there is a layer two event, it will take down the data center interconnect. The problem there is what controls can you do to address that risk? And the answer is very few. There's not much you can do to prevent, you know, UDP unicasts or broadcast storms or NIC failures from propagating to another data center. And then you've got two data centers that are down in some way that are meant to be in DR.
Greg, even if they're not down, if you're overloading the interconnect link, then you're killing all the flows from the traffic trombones.
You're killing the traffic trombones. You're stopping any V motions that might be happening. If that's shared with a storage array, all your storage replication breaks. And even worse, if you've got active-active set up and you've got units on both sides which are polling each other, like, say, active standby firewalls, then they may actually go into a split-brain mode. That would be fun. So then you've got a situation where your design technique to solve that is then to break the layer two data center interconnect out into something that's not used by anything else. That's just so you don't use it to route layer three traffic over it, and then the cost of it starts to get out of hand. Scott, am I explaining this correctly?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, we're describing all kinds of scenarios in which if that DCI link breaks or malfunctions in some way, then there's all kinds of, you know, other effects that you know your active passive firewalls that are pulling each other, as you mentioned, storage replication or storage synchronization that's making data available between the two data centers, in addition to the, you know, quote unquote networking problems that you would have, like, you know, loss of connectivity and that sort of thing.
Although fiber channel over Ethernet can never be used between two data centers, that's just impossible for the protocol to support it, because Ivan had a great post. If you don't understand why fiber channel over Ethernet can't exist over a WAN environment, simply because the latency is too high is the issue. And Ivan has a post which talks about why. So go and check his blog out on that article. But for example, if you were to try and run fiber channel over Ethernet between a site, you might be using that layer 2 data center interconnect to do that. And if you broke that, then your replication fails. And then if you've got two machines, one on each site, trying to poll each other and say, am I up? They'll go active-active, and you will have terrible time recovering from that sort of a failure scenario. Well, it's Greg here. The show went on so long that we've decided to release it in two parts. Now, at this point, was a pretty good time to break it at around about this mark. To give you a teaser of what's coming up next week, here's the next question that Scott asked.
I'm hearing lots of reasons why we shouldn't, but let's kind of bring this back again and say, for better or worse, this is where the industry is headed. So how do we protect ourselves?
And it's a great question. How do we protect ourselves? And that'll be on next week. So for now, I'm going to throw you into the closeout where people talk about what's happening and how to contact them, because that's important, because people give up a lot of time and put a lot of energy in to make the show possible. And I'll look forward to seeing you next week. That's it for the show this week, and thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. Make sure you come back. I'd like to thank our guests for joining us this week. Scott, what are you doing this week, and where can we find you?
Well, this week I'm just spending some time in the lab, so lots of MDS and Nexus and Vplex configuration, and I imagine that everything that I end up playing with this week will find its way onto my blog at blog.scottlowe.org, and you can also follow me on Twitter as Scott_Lowe.
And also, Ivan Pemniak, what are you doing this week, and where can we find you?
You can find me at blog.ioshints.info or on Twitter at @ioshints, obviously. And this week, I'm just polishing the final details for the MPLS webinar on Thursday. That's it.
Hey, I'm going to be there for that one, too.
I know.
I promise I won't taunt you too much.
That's good. Thank you.
Because I know nothing about MPLS. I'm quite keen to learn some more. I know the webinars are going pretty well. They're becoming quite popular, I believe.
Oh, yeah, they are. I'm amazed.
Fantastic. And of course, Ethan, what are you doing this week?
Putting the finishing touches on a project plan to migrate from one public-facing external IP block to another, which is going to break everything, because that's just the way these things go. It doesn't matter how good you plan. You convert over that new block and you spend the next 2 weeks recovering from all the crap that no one can connect to anymore. You didn't hard code that in a host file, did you? A host what? Yeah, okay. Well, tell you what, open up this file and edit it. Anyway, I'll be blogging about that and whatever else at packetattack.wordpress.com. And, of course, I tweet nerdy at ecbanks.
And I'm Greg Farrow, and you can find me at etherealmind.com or on Twitter as @etherealmind. I'm in the final weeks of my current job, and next week I'll be taking some time off over Christmas and unemployed next year. I'm not sure where it's going to take me, but that's where I'm going. So we'd love to hear your feedback about the show. Send emails, follow us on Twitter as @packetpushers, or go to the podcast website at packetpushers.net. And remember, too much networking would never be enough.